the pre-law society of the University of Wisconsin, Whitewater. Would the students please stand? Good seeing you all. The pre-law society makes an annual trip to Madison to hear oral argument, and we're delighted to welcome you. You may be seated. If anyone in the courtroom, including the students, does not have material on this case, there is a synopsis of the case on the desk in the foyer, and you're welcome to get it. I also want to introduce to the court Liudis Romanauskas from Latvia. He is studying international law in Latvia and is visiting in Madison, and we want to welcome you to the court. Let me introduce our court. On our far left is Justice Patience Rogensack. Seated next to me is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. After this case concludes, Justice Bradley will meet with our students and discuss the procedures of the court, not the substance of the case, and anyone who wishes to join that discussion is welcome to do that. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is an empty chair, as is the chair to the left of Justice Bradley. To our left ordinarily sits Justice Prosser. To my right ordinarily sits Justice Wilcox. The two of them will not be participating in this case. Seated next to the empty chair on my right is Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right is Justice Diane Sykes. And I'm sure that Justice Bradley will be back momentarily.
I'm dropping the chairs today, Chief.
But I want to assure you all we have a quorum, and that's what counts.
Four
present. And we will proceed. We're adapting to our surroundings. We've just come back from 2 days sitting in Racine. 02-0359, DeWitt Ross and Stevens versus Galaxy Gaming and Racine LP et al. At the lectern is attorney Anthony R. Varda, representing DeWitt Ross and Stevens. You may proceed, counsel.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm Anthony Varda of DeWitt Ross and Stevens and representing DeWitt Ross and Stevens. Certainly an unfortunate position for an attorney ever to be in, but the entity rule keeps me short, just short of representing myself, so the old adage hopefully doesn't apply. In any event, this is a dispute over collection of a legal bill. It is not a dispute over the quality of the services or the amount of time spent on the account or anything of that sort. That was acknowledged early on in the lawsuit. In fact, unfortunately, this case degenerates into simply an argument over interest. How much and in what amounts, and if at all, interest should be paid on the amounts outstanding. This case arises out of a representation that started in December of 1995, actually the first incident occurred on April 28th of 1995 before the contract was even signed. So we're 9 years in, even longer than five, on this one. The representation lasted from 1995 through June of the year 2000. Shortly thereafter, a suit was commenced because of non-payment. The bill had accrued to a rather substantial amount and had been outstanding for a lengthy period of time, despite repeated requests for payments. As Your Honors know, you can get yourself into a position in private practice where you can't simply walk away from a case for a variety of reasons, one of which being that you would harm your client if you had done so. Delicate negotiations were underway to settle this case, and the withdrawal of counsel for non-payment would undoubtedly have seriously disrupted those negotiations. In any event, there were continued promises of payment and payments along the line, including payments of 18% interest as required by the contract. Now,
Varda, let me interrupt you, if I might, for a minute. As I read the briefs, it seemed to be that an awful lot was being made of whether or not 807.01 paren 4 is or is not a penalty provision. What is your position on that? And if you think it is a penalty provision, why does that make any difference?
Absolutely believe it's a penalty provision. I think that is a fundamental error in the Court of Appeals decision. The Court of Appeals relied on the Erickson case. In the Erickson case, Judge Ike, quoting the earlier Gorham case, said that it was not a penalty and therefore we should he said it was not a penalty. Then the Court of Appeals said, since it's not a penalty, we should not allow it to be 12% to be put on top of 18% because that would effectively be a penalty. And we're not here for penalties. We're just here for time value of money. I think the case law, Gorham, actually says that it is a penalty. Judge Ike got it wrong. He went to the wrong page in the Erickson, in the Gorham case. He should have gone to the next page, and it would have seen that it was, in fact, a penalty. The Court of Appeals, of course, cannot correct this under their rules. They can criticize former cases, but they can't correct it. Even this Court has repeatedly referred to 807.01 interest as penalty interest, and it is. And it's not a penalty in the sense that you're trying to beat up on somebody for doing a bad thing. It is a penalty. It's not a punishment. It is a penalty to the effect that this is how we're going to get you to accept and be reasonable on your settlement. If you don't accept a reasonable settlement, we are going to penalize you with this interest on top. And that goes, actually, to the end of my argument, but I'll bring it forward here because it's appropriate. When the legislature adopted this rule, Senators Cy Bidwell and Bill Babich did this, along with many other laws they passed back then. They chose a specific device. What they did was they took the judgment interest. First, they raised it to 12% from then 6% to discourage people from appealing because 12% was a substantial interest. You know, you weren't going to get a free ride. You weren't going to get the money that you really owe. You're not going to get it for less than the bank's going to give it for it to you for. That was to encourage payment. But if you got a settlement offer back here that you should have accepted because it was reasonable and it was later beat by the ultimate judgment, they took the judgment interest from when it would have ultimately been applied and they moved it forward to the date of the settlement offer. That's where you get the language as to the amount ultimately recovered, the entire amount recovered. That's the judgment date interest being moved forward to the date of the offer of settlement. You know, whatever you were going to end up getting in the end, you'll get interest from this date. We're moving that judgment interest forward, and that is our penalty. You're not going to get the benefit of delaying this action 6 months or a year. We're going to bring that judgment interest forward. You are not going to have the use of the money. You are not going to be able to avoid it. We're going to bring it forward.
Counselor, just so I'm sure I understand what your position is, you're asking for 18% interest from the 1st of January, 1997, until the entry of judgment. And then you agree after that point in time that the judgment runs at 12%, and for the period from the offer of settlement through the, well, forward altogether, you're asking for 12%. Is that correct?
Correct. 807.01 supersedes the judgment statute. We're saying that it should start at the date of offer, settlement, proceed forward. But the merger doctrine takes our contract interest, merges it into our judgment, right, and from there forward is 12%.
Okay, now looking at the interest, I tried to look at your interest case. I have to tell you, it's a little tiny for me to read, but I will eventually find a magnifying glass so I can perhaps better understand it. My question is the interest compounded so that monthly it's added to the balance, and on that balance interest is calculated, or is the interest simple interest?
It's simple. It probably should have been compounded, but we didn't do it that way. It's just simple interest.
Okay, so it's 18% just on the outstanding principal balance.
Correct.
Not 18% on the outstanding balance of principal and interest.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
And when you incorporate that into the judgment, you will then, when you put the 12% judgment interest on, you are paying interest on interest.
Yes.
Because it's going to be incorporated at that point.
That part I understood. I just couldn't figure out from your sheet exactly what happened. Thank you.
Now, why is it owed from January 1 of 1997? Court of Appeals discussed that because interest was due from the date of the invoice. Due upon receipt is the contract language. Under the S-Dream case, it was then due. That interest, you know, we warned the client that we reserved the right to in fact, charge the 18% interest, and normally we would waive, but, you know, that's one of our attempts to settle and get the bill paid. Didn't pay, so we applied it. He then did authorize us to apply a payment we received on his behalf, on the company's behalf, and that 18% interest from 1997 was paid in 1998, accounted for to the client without objection ever until the answer in this lawsuit. And even then, there was no counterclaim for return of the money. They just argued that we should recalculate their debt because we shouldn't have taken out that interest. But for 3 years of legal representation, there was no objection to how we had applied that and paid for it out of payments we received on their behalf. In any event, the guarantee guarantees the full and timely payment. You have to remember that Galaxy Gaming and Racing and Galaxy Casinos had absolutely nothing. It's in the contract. You read the contract. It's not ambiguous. We had to have a guarantee from a substantive party.
Varda, the guarantee, however, doesn't mention interest, does it?
It does not specifically state interest, but you can tell from the intent here, first of all, it makes no sense. Why would you charge the assetless corporation interest and the guarantor would not pay it? But secondly, you can't pay. There's no way for Southwest to pay off the full debt of Galaxy without paying interest. As the Court of Appeals pointed out in the footnote, the U.S. rule is the debtor or the creditor has the right to apply payments made on behalf of the debtor first to interest owed on that account before principal, and the debtor can't say otherwise. So in order to get to the principal obligation, Southwest was going to have to pay the interest anyway. But, you know, that's what we always intended here. It is undisputed that since Galaxy had no money whatsoever, Southwest was going to be loaning the money to Galaxy every month, that was the way it was supposed to work, to pay the debt. It was always the intention of parties that Southwest was going to pay Galaxy's obligations in their entirety. Now, you could term...
Counselor, can I just interrupt you again? In regard to the guarantee before you leave that, that's dated on the same date as the retainer sort of letter that you have. It was, I assume, attached to it since it's listed as page 4.
It was, in fact, part of it. They are part and parcel of the same document prepared by attorney Bruce Harms, and they were signed at the same date. They were all together.
Okay.
And I believe they should be read together because, you know, that's what was understood by the parties at the time.
Thank you.
We have three attorneys here that signed this contract, and we all knew, as the contract recites, that Galaxy had no money. Charging 18% interest to a corporation that has no money doesn't mean much of anything, and that if you don't have the guarantee. And remember, the guarantee says, because the partnership is not presently an operating entity, the payment of all fees and disbursements slash expenses to Axley Brennelson and DeWitt, Ross and Stevens must be guaranteed by you. That's what the parties intended at the time. I don't think there's any ambiguity, but I also think the intent is clear from the document itself. If we had to get past that, now, the argument on the other side has been that it's absolutely clear interest isn't addressed here, therefore it's absolutely clear no interest is owed, and this court should go 180 degrees from the first four judges that looked at this. We have four reasonable judges who found the contract not ambiguous and found that the guarantee covered interest. I think as far as you can, you know, if you buy in to any degree to the other side's argument, the best you can do is say, well, reasonable people differ, it must be ambiguous. That's as far as you can get. You can't get 180 degrees around on this language because too many reasonable people have seen it as covering the guarantee covering the interest. So what you then look to is the extrinsic evidence. What did people think at the time? What did they do? Well, it's very clear in December of 1999, our appendix document 122, Mr. Havnick is being told, look, Southwest, both Galaxy and Southwest owe 18% interest. We don't want to charge you that. Go out to a bank and get somebody else to pay for it. Well, the position now is Southwest didn't owe that interest and apparently didn't owe the balance that was created after earlier interest payments had been made. Those arguments did not appear. For the first time, I learned of it at Mr. Havnick's deposition, because they hadn't answered yet. Then their answer, they made the claim, interest isn't owed. Yet, we have several instances in our record where Mr. Havnick was challenged to state any complaints or objections he had in the billing. And remember, the billing included applications to interest made earlier. If he had any objections, he had none. Representation continued. You know, he did make, there were payments made. Now, Mr. Havnick, I refer to him because he wears both hats. He's president of Southwest. He's president of Galaxy. He has the money at Southwest. He can give the money to Galaxy. It's, you know, it's hard to differentiate, but they are different entities. So we have several layers here. If you've got the plain contract language. If you go to the next level of ambiguity, what did the parties intend? Well, look at what the parties were doing. Obviously they intended the guarantee to cover. Nothing makes sense if it doesn't cover. And then you get to the estoppel argument. Both the trial court and the court of appeals never got past the plain language of the contract, because I think the contract in itself pretty much explains it.
Mr. Varda, what about the concept about right to revoke, right to get the interest?
The right to, pardon?
Right to charge the interest. As you started saying, you don't always bill the client for the interest, but you reserve the right to do that. So one of the issues is that it wasn't until, I think, in the November letter where you were becoming anxious, understandably so, that you then say, hey, you know, there's an interest factor here that's going to run. Boy. So why shouldn't we start interest after you've given that kind of notice, since it seems to be your choice?
It is our choice to waive interest if we so wish. We put in the contract that we reserve the right to charge that interest.
But
if we wished to waive, we could have waived. But it was always there.
I'm sorry, does your contract say the right to waive or the right to charge?
It says we reserve the right to charge 18% interest on all accounts more than 20 days overdue.
You think there's a difference if it said we reserve the right to waive interest?
No, I didn't. In fact, Mr. Harms chose this particular language, and he explained it in his deposition and in his affidavit, if there's any ambiguity. His feeling on how to treat the client was they have to know it's there, but you can waive it, you don't have to charge it. In this case, not only did we first say, look, you got to pay the bill, and if you don't pay it by December 1st, we're going to apply this interest.
Okay.
You know, it was substantially overdue at that point.
Mr. Varda, you have limited time, and you also have other issues that are raised on cross-appeal. And so unless there's an objection by the court, I'd like to move you into what I refer to as the stacking issue.
Yes, 80701. I have to apologize to my colleagues in the legal profession because I think our little dispute here has thoroughly screwed up 80701 from what it was intended to be to start with. And I want to talk a little bit about the dynamics of settlement. This is a practice thing, settlement. What do you use 80701 to do in your everyday litigation? When I use 80701, I try to use it early in litigation, which is exactly what I think the legislature was trying to promote. I try to get my client to go to the lowest number they can possibly go to and live with, and I entice them to do that with the promise that they'll get 12% interest if the other side doesn't accept it. But they got to be willing to live with it. I think doing that is exactly what the legislature was trying to promote. But you can only do that with the 12% penalty interest. Double damages didn't, or double cost didn't work. That's why they had to amend the statute to start with. It wasn't doing anything. It just wasn't enough to move anybody to do anything. The interest, and we're finding in practice now that the 12% interest is significant, and it's taken a number of years before those actually in practice have begun to start taking it seriously, really seriously. And it's beyond, it's not just for that 10-day period.
Okay, I have a question for you. One, is it mandatory that the court impose the 12%?
I think the legislature intended it to be imposed, period. I really do. It is the only mechanism that makes the statute work. I can see how the Court of Appeals decided that common law 5% should not coexist with it. We supplant common law things such as interest with statutes all the time. I understand why the court felt that the 12% required on insurance payments was the same thing, basically, and so it didn't apply there. But here, if you have a commercial contract, and there are I write commercial contracts every day with an 18% clause in it, and it's not because the client, like this one, it's not because you want the 18%, it's because you want to get paid. And sometimes a higher interest rate is what's going to get people to pay it.
Okay. Go ahead.
Let me ask you this. One of the arguments made by opposing counsel is that when you talk about 18% contract interest and you talk about 12% penalty interest and you're also looking at compounding, that you're getting to the point where what's going on is unfair. It's a violation of due process. What's your response to that?
Why is it unfair? We look at 895.40, I think it's 895.40, the triple damages statute. When you use an offer of settlement in conjunction with the triple damages statute, you're applying 36% interest to the actual damages, plus they're getting triple damages. In the Lemon Law, you're applying 24% interest to the actual damages, plus they're getting double damages. The legislature made these choices. They decided there had to be something here that did this. Remember, when we finally took judgment, we got our 18%, and then we applied 12% judgment interest on top of that. All they did was pull the 12% judgment interest forward to the settlement offer date. That's why they should overlap. The 18% is our damages. It could have been $1,000 a day liquidated damage in a construction contract, which would be time-related and perhaps far more severe, but it's interest. It could have been any number of different ways. The nature of damages should not affect the application of the penalty interest. The penalty interest is not damages. They are not damages. Our damages shouldn't be reduced, as Justice Dykeman indicated in his dissent.
Well, that's one of the issues, it seems to me, when you – first of all, the statute says the party is entitled. So I don't know whether it's shall is different than is entitled. But by labeling it a penalty, sort of instantly in my mind, you get to the question of whether it's fair. Because the whole point about labeling something a penalty is you're now penalizing, you're extracting something. Same thing about liquidated damages. You might put in $1,000. The court says, well, that's a liquidated damage is a penalty, and the court's going to decide if it's reasonably related to the contract and to why there are liquidated damages. Is $1,000 equal to what you need?
Remember, as I said earlier, it may be a penalty, but it's not punishment. It is merely the mechanism they selected. They could, the legislature could have decided to reverse the American rule. You pay all the other side's attorney's fees after the offer of settlement for all the continued litigation. Could have done a number of things that would have been perfectly lawful, and I think they were appropriate. And here, they could always pay. Remember, they paid here and avoided 12% judgment interest. You can always pay under protest and continue litigating. You could make an offer to take judgment. They could have done that. It isn't automatic that we're going to get 30% interest because the other side is not a potted plant. They respond. These are strategies or tactics that go with settlement. But the real beauty of 80701 is you can unilaterally change the economics of the litigation, regardless of the nature of your damages. It gets people thinking about settlement early, and if it's possible to settle, it gets them to settle. And you lose that entirely when you cannot use it on commercial transactions that have an interest rate as part of the contract.
Well, settlement's a good idea, and I'm not opposed to it. On the other hand, forcing settlements and keeping people out of court also has a lot of problems. And you want to give people access to the courts, and you don't want to make it so expensive for them that they have to say, good grief, I don't really have a choice anymore. I've got to take it because I can't afford to go to court.
They can always pay under protest, sue for to get it back, which is what happened here on the judgment interest. If we get reversed on appeal, we have to pay them back plus 12% interest. They can also make an offer of
judgment. About the 18% interest, would you give them that back, that too? Or maybe
if they
should charge you 18%?
The court was going to decide ultimately what it was. If they had paid the whole bill off under protest and continued the litigation to convince the judge that they didn't owe the 18%, the judge would have ordered the return of the 18%. I mean,
but they don't have the use of their money in the interim.
That's true, but they avoid 30% interest. So is it unfair? I wouldn't think that would be unfair, because they do have the ability to avoid it. Is it unfair? You know, sometimes the value of the money is not the interest. If you don't have money to pay for something and you need it then and you can't get it, interest isn't really a lot of compensation. Interest here was an attempt not for compensation, at least not initially. Now, of course, the interest is going to pay for all this, and that's all we'll get out of it. This is not a windfall. They have had their day in court, despite everything, even not imposing that, they had their day in court. I don't see it forcing people out of their day in court. It just moves that judgment interest rate forward to the date of the offer of settlement. And remember, you turn down an offer of settlement on your best judgment that you're not going to lose.
I have another question about that.
You're on one more thing, though.
Sorry.
Aren't you beginning to legislate? Isn't this an area where the legislature made a decision? And they were over there fighting this bill about whether they should lower the interest rate from 12%. And the merchants were over there, and people, all these people actually have contracts with interest in them. They were fighting this bill because they wanted to keep it applicable to their contracts. And were unaware that, meanwhile, DeWitt Ross and Stevens had unfortunately got a published case that eliminated it entirely. This is something, if this court upholds the law in that fashion, and it is unfair, the recourse should be to the legislature. The original intent was to have it apply to whatever amount is ultimately recovered, regardless of the nature of damages.
Now, I'm suggesting that maybe the unfairness comes out in adding it to an interest rate of 18%, the stacking issue, which is not, the legislature had nothing to do with that. Legislature didn't think about that.
Legislature did not make any differentiation in the nature of damages ultimately recovered. And in fact, a judgment makes no differentiation in the underlying nature of the claim that results in the number that ends up the judgment. I see my time is up.
Your time is up, counsel. Thank you. Robert H. Friedberg, representing Galaxy Gaming and Racing et al.
Good morning. My name is Robert Friedberg, and I represent Galaxy Companies and Southwest. I would like to start with the guarantee, because there's been a misstatement here as to how this contract was put together. There was no assurance or necessity in this contract that there be a guarantee. The proposal was either pay $25,000 retainer, Galaxy, or if Galaxy is not going to pay a $25,000 retainer, then we would like to have a guarantee by a responsible party. So the 18% interest to say that it had to apply to the guarantee is not accurate. The 18% interest was there because Galaxy, all by itself, if the $25,000 retainer provision had been accepted, would have been the only party responsible for the attorney's fees. And since Galaxy did not have any money, an 18% interest is a risk that the DeWitt firm was not willing to take unless there was 18% interest. As far as the guarantee is concerned, well, they had a company that was good for it, had money, had assets, and paid a lot of money to the DeWitt firm. And for that purpose, there is no actual necessity. It's just like if they made a direct contract with Southwest, would they really put in an 18% interest term, and would Southwest have really agreed to it? The fact of the matter is that the guarantee does not obligate Southwest to pay Galaxy's 18% interest. It is limited.
Counsel, this is a summary judgment case.
Yes.
You got depositions. I have not read them, but I assume there's a separate box, so I assume there's a lot of stuff there. Okay. If there's a dispute between the parties as to whether this guarantee covers the interest, can we do that on summary judgment, or are you saying it has to go back for a hearing on that, evidentiary hearing?
Both sides are contending that the guarantee is unambiguous. And the reason why the DeWitt firm won is because the courts below said that the guarantee was unambiguous and they get interest.
Okay, so I don't have to look at any of the affidavits. I don't have to look at any of the depositions on the meaning of the guarantee.
No. If the court believes that it's not, that it is ambiguous, then it should reverse and send it back. Because both sides are contending that it's unambiguous in their favor. If the court disagrees, the only resolution would be to send it back to the trial court, because none of the lower courts determined that it was ambiguous, but this was the only meaning that could come out of it because of all these boxes that you have.
Mr. Friedberg, then why am I interested in your telling me how this came about? I mean, the reason for telling me how it came about is to tell me something that I don't see on the face of the document, but it does influence me as to how I read the document.
Yes. How it came about is part of the contract. It says that on part four of the agreement with Galaxy, numbered paragraph four, little Roman...
What page of your appendix is
it? It's appendix 151.
Okay. Go ahead.
It says no guarantee would be required from any person or entity if the partnership would pay a retainer of $25,000, which would be reduced by monthly billing. So that is part of all of the transactions. Okay. And therefore, to say that there would... Because they had no money, because there had to be a guarantee, there had to be the 18% interest doesn't fly, because there was the significant potential and probability or possibility that the only party on this contract would be Galaxy, and in that sense, the 18% interest. The fact of the matter is the guarantee just doesn't include interest. And it's written by lawyers.
Counselor, if there were a retainer, they would charge their monthly bills against the retainer, so there'd never be anything for interest to accrue on. So it's kind of a circular argument, don't you think? And the retainer has to be replenished. So if you've always got money there, interest just drops out altogether because there's never anything to charge interest on. Balances are paid within 20 days according to the agreement. So I guess I don't quite see the connect between that argument and the guarantee.
As Mr. Vargas acknowledged, as any lawyer practices law, that you sometimes get bills no matter what. You have retainers. It doesn't mean you automatically withdraw from the case. It doesn't follow. It is not they will withdraw. They reserve the right to withdraw.
No, I'm talking about the effect of a retainer on the accumulation of interest. And if there is a retainer, which was one choice, You can never have the accumulation of interest because the retainer will pay the balance in 20 days. So I don't really see how that provision has much to do with guarantees.
That's assuming that the bills would be kept current, that the retainer would be replenished.
Well, okay, that's
an assumption. And if the Galaxy does not replenish over time, then the DeWitt firm can add the 18%. And that then they can use their other provisions for whatever remedies they have, but it would only be against Galaxy. They'd have the right to add 18%. They'd have the right to withdraw. They'd have the right to sue also. Galaxy. That would be a breach of the contract, just like not paying the bills is a breach of the contract.
But
because the term requires it doesn't mean it's going to be honored at all times.
Right, but if there's a retainer, then there's no guarantee. Okay, so
correct.
The provision that you read to us has nothing to do with a guarantee.
No.
It won't permit the accumulation of interest, and if, in fact, there's a retainer, then you don't have a guarantee. So the guarantee is nothing, right? I don't see how they look
would,
together.
It would have interest if the provision was not honored, just like the provision of paying the bills on time was not honored. There would be a remedy. The point is that when the guarantee came in, it doesn't automatically follow that a guarantee which does not reference interest at all includes interest. And I would suggest that since this is prepared by attorneys, and I would say sophisticated commercial attorneys at that, that the clerks should not give them any leeway on the contracts that they write. They are writing an agreement for a retainer of services or for themselves, and if they did not include interest, they shouldn't be helped out by the courts. They know how to write these things. They can say they'll cover all the debts pursuant to the contract. Everybody knows how to write a broad guarantee. They can say that they'll cover all the debts. They can say they'll cover all the claims against Galaxy. They can say the guarantee is for all damages against Galaxy. They didn't say any of that. What they said was...
Mr. Bieber, let me interrupt you for a minute. When I'm looking at the retainer letter, the first paragraph going to Appendix 151 of your appendix, there's talk in that particular paragraph about being billed for disbursements and other expenses incurred. Then there's at the bottom of that paragraph this language, we reserve the right to charge interest at the rate of 18% per annum, 1.5% per month, on all statements not paid within 20 days after their date. Now, I don't understand if the choice is made, and clearly it's made, to go with the guarantee instead of the retainer, because both the guarantee and the retainer letter are dated December 6. I don't understand why that particular sentence would not apply here.
But this is a retainer letter for Galaxy. And it's a right that is reserved against Galaxy. The guarantee does not say interest. The guarantee says that they're guaranteeing services rendered and disbursements expenses. It doesn't say interest. And I might go on to say that the next sentence in the guarantee says, in the event of failure of the partnership to pay monthly statements, the undersigned agrees that the law firms, in the first instance, look to the undersigned for payment without having to exercise or exhaust any remedies against the partnership. Now,
aren't you ignoring, excuse me for interrupting, but aren't you ignoring the part that says personally guarantees the timely and full payment of all statements?
Yes.
I know you're emphasizing services rendered in disbursements expenses, but it says all statements.
But it's limited by the drafter, a lawyer who knows how to say what he wants to say. And he limited not just the statements for anything. They had to be statements for costs and disbursements and attorney's fees. And I wanted to point out at the very last sentence, without having to exercise remedies against the partnership, the agreement has two remedies against the partnership. One is they can withdraw. And the second one is they can charge 18% interest. Those are remedies against the partnership, not part of the guarantee. I mean, we are dealing, it is not hard to write a guarantee. Everybody in commercial law has written a guarantee that says we guarantee all debts. Well, it doesn't say that.
Mr. Friedberg, well, you're looking again at the same provision that Justice Crooks was. It says you will receive a statement for services rendered and expenses incurred on a monthly basis. So you expect for services rendered $15,000. It might have hours, it might have descriptions. Okay. And then you're going to have a separate little thing at the bottom of your bill, which is going to say expenses, and that'll be listed. And then I'm assuming the bill will add that. Well, we'll add that up, and then say interest.
Not on the bills every month.
Not on the bills.
Correct. You only see those on the bills when a payment has been made. The monthly bills, as we pointed out in our brief, and the court can look at that, doesn't have a monthly accounting of the accumulated interest.
And for that reason, you're reading the guarantee to say, when it says statement for services rendered, you're reading that to mean the top half of the bill that I described.
Yes.
And then the disbursements expenses incurred for that second half of the bill, I would describe. And you're just saying what's missing here in the guarantee is what I described as the third part of a bill.
Yeah, one would assume it'd be on the monthly bills, but they weren't.
They were not. Okay. So when did they start appearing on the monthly bills?
Well, they would appear every now and then when, and remember how these payments were made. There's no doubt that Galaxy owes 18% interest. The payments, all payments for the services were made by Galaxy. Now, Southwest or some other entity would supply the money to Galaxy, but the payment was actually made by Galaxy. After a payment was made, starting in about December of 1997, I believe, but only after a payment was made would there be an accounting of interest. Then the monthly bills would come out. And if there were no payments made, and there would be long stretches without payments made, I can't say exactly none, but there were almost none of those bills had this line at the end that said interest.
Counselor, don't all the bills, though, say that interest will be charged at 18%? Isn't that pre-printed on the billing forms?
No.
There's nothing about interest on the billing forms?
Not on the monthly bills.
Oh, but Galaxy didn't object when there is an allocation to interest.
When there's a payment.
When there was a payment.
On some, but not all
payments. So how do you explain that?
Well, Galaxy was paying the bills and they owed interest.
All right.
There's no problem with that.
Your position is that Southwest doesn't owe the interest.
Yes. It owes 5% common law interest. The term full payment for services rendered, timely and full payment, sets a time when Southwest becomes responsible for the debt. And under well-established principles, that would be liquidated and would be subject to the 5%. So it does owe interest. It owes interest under common law. I don't deny that.
Okay. That's the Southwest. All right.
Now, I think the court really ought to set a very strict standard for attorneys doing fee agreements, that they should be extremely clear as to what they are charging for. And when they put in limiting terms, they should be held to their words, and the court should not allow the attorneys later on to come in and say that it doesn't mean what it says. One other thing, the first time in this record that shows that a direct claim was made against Southwest for the interest was in late 1990, 1989, I believe. And at that time, the work of the case, November 5, 1999, and it was in a letter which also contained a threat that the deal would never go through unless this bill were paid in full. Now, the deal had nothing to do with the case. It had to do with there would never be approval of the project, which only could be approved by the governor. That was the first time, specifically, where a letter was sent saying Southwest owed this. At that time, the representation was nearly done. There was nothing much left to do. The case was into negotiations. As Mr. Havanick's affidavit shows, Mr. Varga did not participate really in the negotiations. And out of all the bills, maybe $10,000, $12,000 of work was performed after that date. Now, I know the court is interested in the stacking question. Before getting to the stacking question, we believe that there was no valid offer under the statute. And the reason for that is there was a condition put onto the offer of settlement. The condition was payment within 15 days of acceptance of the offer. We believe that the statutory offer cannot contain any conditions. It should just be for just what the statute says. You can offer a money amount plus costs.
Counselor, what about 807.01 sub 3, which gives you a 10-day string to respond to a statutory offer right in the statute?
No, you have 10 days to accept or do nothing.
Right. Well, they put 15 in there.
Well, they have 15 to pay, not to accept or reject. He says, provided there be payment within 15 days.
Ah, that's your claim. Okay.
That's a very, that is a condition. And since, as we believe, the only thing that, that can happen with an accepted offer for money is that you can, one of the parties can get a judgment. The party making the claim gets a judgment. Go to the clerk. The clerk is the one who attaches or assesses costs. And the statute contemplates a judgment. And that's the only remedy. Collection is another matter. The Court of Appeals understood that this presented a problem and created a solution to the possibility of unreasonable conditions. And the solution they have is unrealistic, impractical, and I believe improper. And that is...
That you like it, Mr. Freeburg?
Pardon? I don't agree with them. No, I don't agree with them. I think they were wrong.
As Justice Bradley would say, strong words to follow.
Right.
I mean, here's a statute that's supposed to help in settlement and end litigation, and they provide a procedure that creates litigation, collateral litigation over what's a reasonable, what's reasonable and what's unreasonable. Settlement outside of the statute have all sorts of terms, confidentiality agreements, payment schedules, I mean, innumerable terms, non-competes. They're all part and parcel of settlements and conditions, including payment schedules. Courts, this statute does not authorize courts to get into the middle of these things. All you do is you make an offer for money. If it's accepted, somebody either pays it and the case is dismissed, or it's dismissed one way or the other, you get a judgment. And collection is another matter.
Well, Mr. Freeburg, what's wrong with the conclusion of the Court of Appeals that the logical corollary to the principles that they discuss is that an offer is not effective under 807.01 paren 3 if it imposes an unreasonable condition? And they're saying that a condition saying payment if you're going to accept the offer ought to be made within 15 days is a reasonable condition. It's going to encourage settlement. What's wrong with that?
They didn't say this was reasonable. There was no way to know whether it doesn't say acceptance within 15 days. It's payment within 15 days.
I understand that, but the Court of Appeals' conclusion, since they say that this offer of settlement was okay, Their conclusion is that this was not an unreasonable condition.
I don't think the question, this is the first case ever where courts said that you could challenge the reasonableness of conditions. There was never any factual presentation as to whether this was reasonable. How do you determine reasonableness of a payment schedule? Are we going to have discovery? Are we going to determine if the company is cash short at the particular moment but has a lot of fixed assets as to what fixed assets can be sold and whether they can be sold in 15 days? Well, while it may appear on its face to be reasonable, it's not necessarily reasonable.
Doesn't the court basically look at the purposes behind the statute and say that such a condition fosters those purposes? Isn't that what the Court of Appeals is saying?
They didn't say that. They said there was nothing in the statute to prohibit conditions. And the purpose, if the legislature wanted to say that on a money judgment payment, that it should be, that it requires payment, they should have said so. What they said was that you, party goes to the clerk and a judgment is entered. The clerk puts in the costs. That's the result. It's a very simple mechanism which has been made incredibly complicated by this decision.
And now, let's just play out the theme. So, I get the offer from the DeWitt firm to settle. It's less than I might be held to owe if I went to court. I might not agree with it all, but it's not bad. But I don't have a dime. In my example, let's take out the guarantee. I don't have a dime, but at least, you know, someday I might have a dime. And so I can't pay within 15 days, but I want to stop interest running. I want to get rid of this case because I don't want to keep paying my lawyer, and it's a real drag on me emotionally. So I accept. So the DeWitt firm goes down to the clerk's office and gets the judgment. Okay, I don't pay. Can't sue on the judgment. I mean, you can, but you're not going to. You're going to execute.
What does the clerk enter for the judgment? An injunction to pay within 15 days?
That's why I'm playing this out. The clerk is going to enter a judgment for whatever the money, $100,000. That's all it can do.
Well.
But then the lawyer comes in and says, yeah, but you didn't pay in 15 days, so we have to get rid of the judgment. And we have to continue with the case, and you're going to owe me more money, and the interest keeps running. So that way it plays out?
Well, what the court said was that it more than suggests that we would have a right to challenge the reasonableness of the, how is a party who receives an offer to know whether it's reasonable or not reasonable and wants to cut it off? That's not what the legislature said.
Well, your real point, at least what I'm hearing, is offer to settle, which is accepted, or to end the matter, period.
Yes.
Whether you can ever collect on that judgment is another issue.
Yes, that's exactly what the legislature is saying, in my judgment, and I think that they didn't. And what we have here is the specter of collateral litigation and testing the reasonableness. And when do you do it? In the middle of the litigation? And there's another practical matter with that. The trial judge then knows about the settlement. What happens then when you go in the middle of the case and the trial judge knows about a settlement offer and a question of whether reasonableness? Does the judge then have to leave the case because the judge gets so embroiled into the settlement process? It doesn't work, and it doesn't make any sense.
Mr. Freebert, your opposing counsel, as I understand their position, says this was an offer of settlement. It wasn't an offer of judgment. And it draws the distinction between offers of settlement and offers of judgment. What's wrong with that?
If it's a plain old offer between parties who are litigating with each other, it doesn't matter at all. But to come under the statute and try and get 12% interest, you've got to comply with the statute. And it's got to be strict compliance with the statute. And we can negotiate about anything, but to come under the statute and get the 12%, that statute doesn't suggest anywhere that there can be anything other than a judgment entered, and none of this collateral discussion over whether a term attached is reasonable.
Well, the Court of Appeals seems to rely on a case called White versus General Casualty, and their approach is that under that case, 807.01 3 and 4 cannot be used unreasonably for settlement. And they point out, in their opinion at least, that you made no objection or never claimed that this particular offer of settlement was an unreasonable one. Are you now claiming that it is?
I'm claiming that it was not a valid offer under the statute, and then we don't get to the 12% stacking question because they didn't follow the statute. I'm also saying that that term of an unreasonable offer has to do with crunching down on litigation so that people are forced into settling. This is a new rule. It's a sunburst rule from the Court of Appeals. We had no notice that we could challenge the reasonableness of a term.
Now, your view then, to put it in terms of that Justice Crooks did.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Your view is that 807.01 deals with an offer of judgment, not
yes.
an offer of settlement.
Yes, that's offer. The result.
Well, it says in 807.01, after issue is joined, but at least 20 days before the trial, the defendant may serve upon the plaintiff a written offer to allow judgment
right.
to be entered.
Yes.
And you're saying that's it.
That's it.
No other conditions.
That's it. And you can't add terms. When you start adding terms, you can do that, but you're not under the statute.
And
we looked at 803.10, which was amended by court rule to if there's a person dies after a settlement has under the statute under 807.01 to comply with the plaintiff, the result is the judge enters a judgment. That's all you get. You get a judgment. You don't get collection. There are no terms. It's a simple procedure.
Counsel, but under the statute, isn't there an offer of settlement referred to? I think it's a little
yes.
unclear.
It is.
I mean, but we have both in sub 3 and sub 4 this animal that's referred to as offer of settlement. If there is an offer of settlement,
yes.
How do you three. Handle that in 4 also?
These are all read together, and as I'm saying, 803.10 was changed by court order, I believe, to accommodate the entry or the passage of paren 3, which you've just referred to, and it refers to it in terms of entry of judgment after deceased. That's how it's been read. 803.10 can be read together with 807.01, but that's the meaning of it. Otherwise, we have plaintiffs having the right to put in terms and conditions, defendants can't. I don't think that's what was meant by anybody.
Counselor, it seems that there are very different provisions in 807.01 sub 1 and sub 3. In sub 1, I would certainly agree with you that you offer to allow judgment to be taken against you for a specific amount, and that's what's entered. But in sub 3, it doesn't use the word judgment at all. It said that there may be a written offer of settlement for a sum or property or to the effect specified with costs. So why shouldn't I read to the effect specified as the provisions for payment that are included in this offer?
Well, or to the effect specified is also in paren 1. It's in both places. And the or is just it's to accommodate different types of cases.
Okay.
The effect specified would be a non-money case.
Why isn't the use of the word settlement in sub 3 importing something different than judgment in sub 1?
Well,
why didn't the court use judgment both places?
It's because also in sub 3 it says the addition of costs. Costs are only taxed by the clerk after a judgment. And so those mean the same thing. And it does say later on that you can file it with the clerk of court. What's the clerk of court supposed to do with it? Enters judgment and tax costs. I mean, just because they left that phrase out, they still have some duty for the clerk of court.
Mm-hmm.
And the clerk's duty is, I think, obvious. Enter judgment and tax costs. And that's it. Not to enter an injunction to pay within 15 days or a schedule of payment over the next 2 years or any of those things, or in a default that the case is reopened. All of these terms, Kate attacked me, all of these terms that are in private negotiations are not what the legislature contemplated in making a statutory settlement offer. It's plain, clear, simple, and not complicated, and the Court of Appeals made it complicated.
Thank you.
If you want a brief word on stacking.
I want two very, very brief words, Mr. Breber. One, if the Court accepts this argument, obviously you don't have to get to stacking, but let's take a brief word on that. And then you have cross-appealed. And assuming, and you did a conditional cross appeal, if I understand it. So assuming, just for the purpose of arguing, you should prevail, then do you want the court to rule on your cross appeal?
Yes, as our cross appeal is on the validity of the offer. It's also on what the meaning is of the guarantee, principally. There's some other issues, but
there's
those
some
are
other
major issues.
But it was a conditional cross appeal.
Yes,
they didn't. Okay.
But the court granted review.
Okay, I understand that.
So I assume we're here.
That. I'm just asking you. Okay, you're brief, very, very brief.
Very briefly.
Because we're going to be drowned out by music.
Yeah, very briefly. Up the Grove, which is the principal case 15 years ago, I think sets the pattern. This interest is very different from any other kind of damages. It constantly grows. There's no other kind of damage that's really quite like interest. And what Up the Grove said is that the amount recovered is that you move the timetable back from verdict, when the 12% would start, to the time of the offer. And therefore, the statutory offer in that case, the 12%, and later on in the other case, the common law, 5%, goes up to the time when the offer is in, and then the 12% takes over, because that's the effect of it. And that would work with any kind of interest. The fact of the matter is, we didn't owe $400,000 when this offer was made. We owed less. There's nothing unreasonable about taking the policy of verdict and moving it back to the time of the offer and say the 18% stops there and the 12% takes over, although I have no objection to continuing the 18%, which is what the Court of Appeals did. They thought that was reasonable under these circumstances. Otherwise,
either or for you.
Pardon?
You view it as either or.
Yes, either or. Yes. And then finally on this point, if the court rules you can stack like this, every commercial case which has interest, there are lots of them, any time a defendant puts in an answer, an offer is going to go in for almost the total amount due, because there's no way, because the damages keep going up, and you can, whatever the interest rate is in the commercial paper, just tack on 12%. It would be a dereliction of a plaintiff's lawyer not to take advantage of this. I do not believe that's what the legislature intended.
Thank you, Mr. Freebert. Mr. Varda.
It's a lot to respond to. First of all, the Wisconsin Law Journal raised an interesting point we haven't talked about here today. And was one modification I think should be addressed, and that is that at the date of the offer, the amount the offer of settlement is for should be less than what would be due, together with the interest due to that date. I think that should be the way the rule comes out. And they raised this issue. Our offer was less than what was owed on that date, together with interest. And I think that's the way you have to interpret it. I certainly hope that you'll take another look at 807.01 and how it really works. Here's how it really works. Under sub 1, the defendant can make an offer of judgment. When the offer of judgment is accepted, the clerk automatically enters the judgment because they offered to do the judgment, the offer was accepted. It is then entered by the clerk. That's what the statute says. There's no reference to the judgment is for some in that subsection 1. The idea is under sub 1, all you're going to get is a judgment. Under sub 3, it's the plaintiff saying, I will accept the sum of. The sum is an amount of money. It is not a judgment. The reason the clerk is not allowed to simply enter something under sub 3 is because it doesn't anticipate entry of judgment. It anticipates payment. I mean, what Mr. Freebird is saying here.
No, the next sentence, counsel says what, you're right, a plaintiff's is an offer.
Right.
And it has to wait for acceptance. Then it says that if the defendant accepts it, the defendant can file the offer, file it with notice that it's been served and accepted with the clerk of court.
Yes.
What's the clerk going to do with it?
Nothing. Unless. Now, remember, they're supposed to pay. If they don't pay, what's your recourse? You move for judgment on the acceptance. Or, because you are the non-breaching party. Remember, this is a simple contract. This is an offer and acceptance. It's a contract. I offer to settle if you pay me so much money. You didn't pay me that amount of money. You breached the contract. I am the non-breaching party. I can decide that whether or not I want to take judgment on that offer now. It's not the same thing. I wanted money. I wanted to get paid. But I could take the judgment if I wanted to. It isn't the breaching party's decision that you can only get an offer. What he is creating in his discussion here, what he will create is nobody can expect to get paid in the state of Wisconsin an offer of settlement. You cannot force anybody to pay you. No matter what you say, they can just say, nah, 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 you get a judgment, not money. And you're stuck.
Well, isn't that what happens under subsection 1?
Yes, but you see, the plaintiff is voluntarily agreeing to just take a judgment. When you accept under 1, you already know you're getting a judgment. Now, what I'm going to settle for cash versus judgment, are two different things. That's why in sub 3, we have to have it open for payment, and payment pursuant to the terms, to the effect thereof.
Then why isn't any settlement offer come under 3?
Why doesn't any settlement offer?
You agree to settle with me for $100,000.
For payment of?
Payment of $100,000. I'm to keep this confidential. I'm not to release depositions or any other information. I'm to pay, since you know I can't give you $100,000 tomorrow, I'm supposed to pay $10,000 a month for X number of months with interest at X and Y. And if I fail to do that, then I'm going to agree to a judgment. Why isn't that? Can you give me that kind of offer under
sure.
this? And if I don't take it, then you're going to
if I included,
have 12%?
If I included my offer, the ability to pay over time, that's fine. But it's the amount. How much are you going to pay me? To determine whether you have exceeded the settlement offer, you look at what's being paid.
No, but I may be willing to pay you that, but not be willing to keep it closed.
Well, if I can't get that as a matter of right in the proceeding, I've just screwed up my offer of settlement because I'm asking for something I'll never be able to exceed because I'll never get a confidentiality agreement if I win the case. So I just made a big mistake, and that's a bad offer.
Then why isn't this a bad offer?
This is not a bad offer because all we did was offer to settle for a sum. And the reason we put the deadline in there is because Mr. Havnick always promised to pay someday. So when was that day going to be? Once we stopped the accrual of interest and came to an exact amount of money that would be paid to us, if he didn't pay in 30 days, didn't pay in 60 days, didn't pay in 90 days, or worse yet, Southwest did not accept, and Galaxy accepted. Galaxy has no money. What are we going to do with them? Move for judgment on the offer? Great. Now we've got a judgment. We have now just merged our contract. We no longer have 18% interest, and it's down to 12%, but they're not going to pay it anyway. Now, on the subject of interest, going back to what I said earlier, there is no way for Southwest to pay in full what was owed to it by Galaxy without paying the interest, because interest, it's the law of the case now. Interest is the creditor's right to apply any payment made on behalf of the debtor first to interest. So any payment we ever receive from Galaxy or from Southwest applied to the Galaxy account would be applied first to interest. And in order for Southwest to pay in full, which was the guarantee.
No, the guarantee was the statement of services.
They said they would pay all statement of services in full. But before they can get to those statement and pay those services, and incidentally, interest was on statements or in an accompanying letter, and the final statement rendered in July of 2000 included all the interest. And unfortunately, our computer system won't calculate interest, and I can't get anybody to change that, so I have to send a letter every time saying, and by the way, interest is still accruing. If you look at the record, you will see numerous, over and over again, reminders to Mr. Havnick that interest is accruing here. And that's part of this bill.
So I just want to back you up again into 80701 sub 3. So if I understand what you're saying, plaintiff can make an offer of settlement for a sum of money, who you made it for a specific dollar amount, and if they had agreed to that, you could have filed it then with the clerk, and nothing else would happen. If they didn't pay you, you had the choice of moving to convert it to a judgment or continuing the lawsuit?
You are then the non-breaching party to a contract. As the non-breaching party of the contract, your options are to enforce the contract, i.e. take judgment, or to reject the contract, i.e. continue with the lawsuit, it didn't happen. That's why it's set up that
way.
Okay,
so you'd have to start another lawsuit if you're going to sue on this document that's in there as a breach of contract.
No. That document, remember, what they agreed to do was pay me. They didn't pay me. They breached that contract. I declare it null and void. I continue with my lawsuit. It's the only way you can do it, because we aren't going to settle anything out there if you don't have the right to demand payment. The difference between what you're going to accept for cash now as opposed to a judgment that you're going to have to go and collect is rather substantial. And I think we all know that. And the legislature set it up this way. It works very neatly this way. And that is that you can demand to be paid. Now, all we did, and if you look at their brief, they say they had a reasonable time to pay thereafter. We defined reasonable as 15 days after acceptance. In fact, they paid the judgment here within 5 days after taxation of costs. It wasn't an unreasonable period of time. They could have paid it if they wanted to. And if they really wanted to raise this issue, they could have accepted, not paid, and forced me to do exactly what I said I'd do, and that would be declare it void and proceed with litigation. And they could have taken that to court, and they could have tested that issue right then and there if they wanted to do the settlement. You know, they could have brought that to a head right then and there, but they didn't do that because they didn't want to do the settlement.
Mr. Varda, your time has expired. Do you have something you really want to say very, very quickly? I give you the same opportunity.
Yes. I, the one thing that troubled me in the colloquy between the Chief Justice and counsel, and that is the reason it's being argued that there is no ambiguity in the contract is because on the undisputed record here on summary judgment, ambiguity is decided against them. Mr. Havnick could not testify that his intent at the time this contract was entered into was not to cover interest in the guarantee. Gave him ample opportunity, several pages worth, wouldn't say it. Why not? Because we all knew that interest was covered by the guarantee. Mr. Harms affirmatively said it was. I affirmatively said there is no factual dispute on the affidavits and the depositions. So if we go to the next step of ambiguity, we can still solve this on summary judgment, and Lord forbid we go back for a trial. I don't think it's necessary. It's pretty straightforward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Avarda. Thank you, Mr. Freeberg, for your arguments this morning. And the court will be in recess until 1:30.